Okay, good afternoon. So as you can see, the CEASE partnership is very big in Baltimore, Southwest Baltimore. And as you can see, what you had was a start to kind of finish progression of how the program has evolved. It didn't always start this way. It came from lessons learned that we have done, I mean, basic lessons learned that we've learned basic from doing the different phases. So as we get into it, these are acknowledgments in regards to the funding. There's no conflict of interest to disclose. As said by my colleagues, smoking is one of the leading causes of premature death in the world. What we found is that individuals, when they smoke, they end up with more health-related problems. They end up with basically premature death. Smoking cessation works. Research has shown that when people engage in smoking cessation programs, they have a reduced in the amount of cigarettes they smoke, but also, and this is also consistent with diverse populations. As previously mentioned, the CEASE partnership began in 2002 with a community needs and asset mapping survey. From there, tobacco was identified as a major concern among stakeholders. This is important because as the community's assessment, they were able to identify what they wanted to work on in that process. The first partnership was at a federally qualified health care center who had a strong interest in smoking cessation. So we already had the buy-in from this center. This led to additional connections with other service providers in the community and led to what we call the beginning of the Community Action Board. I want to stress the importance of the Community Action Board because the Community Action Board is kind of what gives us our power in community-based participatory research. For this Community Action Board with CEASE, they were the highest decision-making authority for the program. They were the community experts on the intervention. They had the authority included deciding when the intervention began and finished, who should be included or excluded from services, what level of incentive to use, how we should conduct recruitment and follow-up, how to analyze the data, and how and when to report the findings to other community partners. I want to stress again the importance of the Community Advisory Board because with this, it gave the community a voice in the research. Where if you've seen research done before, the researcher kind of guides the research, kind of decides what's going on, and kind of pushes the research agenda on the community. This involved the community in the research and let them provide us feedback about what they want to happen inside their community, which makes it the community-based participatory approach. What we found is that basically when individuals start smoking, it's difficult to quit. We have high rates of relapse, and we have basically individuals who continue that cycle of smoking addiction. Research has also found that those who start smoking cessation programs leave prior to completion, and those rates are especially high in the underserved population. So we're talking about participant dropout. Within the context of smoking cessation, participant attendance and retention are two outcomes which should be significantly studied and interventions to increase those. Research has demonstrated that consistent attendance and retention and treatment condition has resulted in better outcomes when compared to those who left early, despite attendance and retention being key points for intervention and thus leading to better outcomes. Research has minimally addressed this issue to a very large degree. So why do we want to use CBPR? Well, it's basically using the community. So it's a question that answers itself. Anytime that you can engage the community and involve them in the research, you're going to have better outcomes because they become the community expert. Imagine for a second if you had to go to your doctor, right? Your doctor doesn't say anything to you. They come in and tell you, oh, you have high blood pressure. They don't ask you for any input about your health condition or what's going on, and they basically prescribe something to you, get some data, and then leave out the room. You would feel kind of slighted, right? So that's kind of what has been happening with research that doesn't use the CBPR approach. They come in, they collect their data, they leave the community, don't really provide any incentives or any benefit to the community, but report on their data. The CBPR approach kind of eliminates that by including the community and letting them have that voice, that the control over what we're looking at. You know, Tamika got very emotional about what was going on, but she felt the connection with the research and the community. She even talked about how her kids were involved in the photo voice, how she was involved, how she was empowered to engage in this program as part of her community. We all work within the Morgan Mile, so So to include the Morgan Mile Southwest Baltimore community in the research and allowed them the decision-making capacity about what happens in their community made all the difference in this research. So we're going to talk about what happened in the different phases. So in phase one, what we saw was a sample size of 404 participants, but we had a 9.4% quit rate. Additionally, we only had 13.6% rate of participants that stayed for more than six or more sessions. It's better than nothing, but we could do better. So what we did was we started looking at how we can improve this. Now, this was a process that was ongoing based off of information gained at phase one. So we looked at data sharing with our partners, so give and take with our partners to gain additional knowledge. Exit interviews from our participants to find out what's going on. What do they think about the program? What kind of improvements can we make? How can we make their experience in smoking cessation and cease intervention better? And then we had a lot of qualitative research that gave them a voice about what they liked or did not like about the intervention. Some of the identified problems was in phase one was the clinical setting. If you remember phase one, we had a nurse practitioner and a doctor that worked with the intervention. So they felt like the setting was too much like treatment. So there was also a strong concern of mistrust among community members. They had bad experiences with previous research studies, and they felt like outsiders were coming into the community. So with that, we had some identified solutions. We moved to a community-based setting to increase access to the CEASE program. The use of peer motivators, which helped to normalize struggles with quitting, provided a common space for discussion, and removed authority figures, which is typically seen as a researcher and or clinician. We also had the use of peer support, which decreased the mistrust. If I'm your neighbor and I'm involved in this program, I come to you and say, hey, there's this great program that is about smoking cessation. You should come join it. It's going to have a lot more leeway than if I'm the researcher. Hey, do you want to come join my research study? It's going to take a whole lot of I guess you'd say, it adds that added benefit of, I know you, you've done it. Now I can also join it because I trust you. So that led to phase two. Our phase two, here's phase one study. Phase two, what you see, if you look down at the bottom of the screen, you'll automatically see that in the column for six or more, we had an increase from 13.6 to 50.8 that actually stayed for six or more sessions. We also had an increase in the number of people that quit, which is always a good thing. Some pictures of our CEASE participants. And then phase three, we took it to another level. We changed the curriculum. We got input from exit interviews and qualitative interviews. And from there, we saw, again, phase one. We saw phase two. And in phase three, we had a slight reduction in those that stayed six or more sessions. And we had a slight reduction in those that quit. But this was also a group that we expanded to more community settings, and we also had more mental health, more comorbidity with this population. So that would account for the decreases that we saw, but still significant findings. So here's all three studies at the screen. As you can see, we had very significant findings from phase one, two, and three, and that we also found that with that, the intervention was working in maintaining people longer in the intervention, and also they were quitting their smoking habit. So predictors of retention. What is it that kind of accounted for those that stayed in sessions six or more? We saw that age was a predictor. So if you were older in that session, you stayed a little bit longer. We saw that education made a difference. So those that graduated from college had a higher probability of staying six more sessions. And we also saw that employment was a factor. So if you did not have a job, you were more likely to attend more sessions. So that could also make sense because you have more time to attend sessions. So you may be a little tired after you get off work. So additional predictors included anxiety and depression. So those who had less anxiety stayed for more sessions. which makes sense because you're also accounting for the comorbidity in that population. Cigarette quantity, if you smoked less, you stayed for more sessions. Barriers to quitting, if you had less barriers to quitting, you stayed for more, but that also makes sense because if I have a significant amount of barriers, think about child care, transportation issues, access, I can't get on the bus, that's going to prevent me from participating in the smoking cessation program. But also, if you look at health problems, if those who did not have health problems or did not see an issue with their health also stayed longer. If you look at the feelings of stress, little interest or pleasure in doing things, feeling down, all those things kind of speak to the comorbidity of the mental health that's kind of going in. They also were significant in the study. So here's the take-home point that we wanted you to know. So what are the lessons learned that we have? So using CBPR approach resulted in an increase in attendance, retention, and quit rates in phases 2 and 3. CBPR resulted in better engagement and buy-in from the community. Using a community action board for decision making became one of the key selling points that helped the intervention. Again, I want to stress the using of the community action board. You have to get that community buy-in. And I want to point out that, yes, we work with a primarily African-American population, but that does not automatically make me a community member because I'm African-American. I have to know the population. I have to know who's involved. I have to make those connections with the population in order to have that buy-in. So the community action board used community members, existing members. It resulted in empowerment, and it resulted in additional buy-in from the community. CBR assisted with cultural mistrust, using peer motivators, take the authority out of it. With the taking the authority out of it, I, as a clinician or the researcher, am no longer seen as an authority figure. I now have peer motivators who can relate to the community, and it seems less like research and more like an intervention that is there to help the community. Switch to a community-based setting. Anytime that community members can stay in their community and participate in an intervention is going to be better. If they have to come to an office-based setting or a hospital, it's going to, I'm not really interested in that. And then you have to account for those barriers. Remember I said those that had more barriers participated less in treatment. So if we have easy access to the intervention within their community, you're going to have an increase in probable increase in session attendance. Thank you.
Well, I hope you have questions. We have several of the peer motivators in the room. We have the co-PIs on the project. We have students who have worked on it. So, and by the way, if you would like to share some of your CBPR experiences, including any experiences helping people to stop smoking, which we know is very, very hard, please do that. Yes?
Well, that's a very good question. This is the last year of our funding for the SEEDS project. So what we have been doing, we have put together a proposal to basically expand this to youth and also include alcohol. So the new version of our intervention would be called SEEDS and REACH, which REACH is about the alcohol, but we create synergy, like when we address tobacco use, we want to also address the alcohol, and yes, the question. And another thing that Tamika didn't mention, because of the wonderful achievement of their project, this year they gave us like 3 times more funding, and Tamika and Sharita will be working with 85 students on 4 different projects. It would be a production team working on social media and music editing. It would be a photo voice project working with kids from 3 schools, and it would be 2 performing school students that they're going to reach 15,000 people. And a youth advisory college.
Yes.
As far as the cessation program with Tobacco Users, if you said this, forgive me, but bring presentation. I was wondering, did you provide like knee replacement therapy or any other incentive along with the cessation program?
Fernando, do you want
to?
I just not long ago, I was a peer motivator for CEE, so I did do classes. We did provide incentives to, and it wasn't for attendance, it was for the paperwork that they turned in at the end of the class, and we also provided patches and gum and lozenges for the participants. That's sort of what helped get them to quit, instead of just trying to go at it cold turkey, which some people opted to do, but we saw a higher quit rate with the people that did try. And the first day, that's what we did tell them, just try. This is a new, I know you've tried to quit a million times, let this time be different. Try, just have an open mind and try what we're trying to tell you to try. So yes, we did.
What kind of incentive?
We gave each participant $10 for each class for the whole, when I first started, we had 12 weeks. For every week, we gave them $10 for the paperwork at the end of the class. So after that was over, we have them come back for follow-up, and we paid them $25 for the follow-up. So a lot of people came because they needed the money. So you got to look at where we are performing and what communities we were working in. So the money did help a lot. So.
Thank you.
Yes.
The story about working with you, I think it was just amazing. The children are the future. I was wondering though, while you were working so intimately with the youth, I imagine that some of the youth were children of smokers themselves. So I was wondering if they shared anything or any impact that they had on how to cope, if their parents were smoking as well.
I think that's why I'm so passionate about what's going on. Right after we started with the performances, with the kids' parents and their grandparents were coming to our classes and doing things, and the kids, as they were learning fast, would go home and be like, "Mom, did you know every 8 seconds someone dies in the United States from a smoke-related illness?" Or they knew the fact. They were like, "Mom, you know about first-hand smoke, but do you know second and third-hand smoke are as detrimental?" Like, the kids would go home with the fact. The parents, we had a class, and I'm so serious. One of our classes was at a church in Southwest Baltimore. The class was filled. We had 15 people. 11 of the people were parents and grandparents of the children in our program. So understanding that educating the kids was educating the community. Their parents would come to classes, and then when the parents were doing stuff and they were trying to quit, the kids would come to the next meeting like, "My mom needs more patches. She's quitting." They were so excited that they were making the difference that was getting their parents to quit. So yes, it really does make a big difference by educating our kids. It really does.
Yes.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you because a lot of people don't use photo voids in the adult form, and part of what's challenging with photo voids is you do it and then you have to get out of the way. And I just think you've got a great story of the power of photo voids and intervention with you, with your community. We can get out of our own way, and they help very much. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
One of the things that I would say about that I have noticed about the kids who participated in Photo Voice is they know they're special. You know, somebody has let them know they're special, and then they are, and they carry that forever. It's not just a new perspective on things. It's not just becoming a reporter. It makes the kids special. It's magic.
And I would like to add something. In 2011, we did the first Photo Voice, and that was when we met Tamika through her daughter. So basically, Tamika was introduced to CEE through her daughter, and then, that became such an interesting intervention and experience that later on, Tamika went and found all those kids.
Yeah.
That they were in their middle school and now they're a senior graduating since. Yeah. And then you tell about
there were 24 students in the initial project that my daughter took place in, and it took place over an 8-week period, and the kids came back every week. So I'm that mom that I don't just drop my child off. I go and I sit, I watch, I see what's going on. So I got to know the kids. Well, once I started working with the youth for CEASE, I'm just wondering, well, where are they? What's going on with them? So through Facebook and Instagram, they're like, hey, if you were one of the kids, you're my daughter's Facebook page and all that stuff. Found 17 of those 24 kids. And I'm proud to tell you that not one of them took. Not one. So understand that something that small makes a big difference in the rest of their lives. So if you don't think it's working, those numbers speak out.
And then I want to add on to that piece that Tamika then in turn was a project facilitator on the 2014 Photo Voice project. So she was a project facilitator along with two other youth to have that youth engagement piece and another adult. So it was five facilitators including me in total. So she keeps going.
Like the Energizer Bunny, yes.
Yeah.
I just want to congratulate the entire team on your success. Great work and well done. And when it comes to the mechanisms involved in building the station, I'm just wondering if you think the same model can be applied to other health communities. I agree, even though those mechanisms would be different when it comes to nutrition or physical activity, but given the success, I'm wondering what would you see in future applications as it relates to the summer health community?
I'm so glad that you asked that question. So the point is that
the question is that
we have this peer-based model at the community setting, which is basically a peer support, a guided facilitation using some curriculum that have come out of some research partnership and doing research in phases, so you learn from the intervention and then you apply the lessons learned to the next phase. So this model actually can apply to any other behavioral health problem. So it's not just about, that's why for the next phase we decided to add alcohol. Because like there is a gap in the health system, in our health system that, you know, you can go to for specialized care to the house. They can send you to, you know, other general hospitals. You can get a prescription for many of the health conditions. There is no place for behavior change. And those behavior change, as you saw, cannot be fully addressed, efficiently addressed through clinical settings. So it takes a community that's become empowered to help each other, and that requires some, you know, kind of defining all these things into an institution. So that people come to this institution, they change their behavior, they step up, and then they become the peer leaders, they become the peer motivators, and they help other people. And then you generate new programs, you know, so you add programs, and it becomes kind of a non-profit that follows the rubrics of the CBPR. It's a non-profit that basically integrates the NGO type organization with the health and fitness type of organization, and kind of a research organization. So it's a research integrated research center, NGO, and a health and fitness club. And that's the kind of future that we are envisioning for the CEASE. That CEASE become kind of a model organization, and then, you know, we add to those programs over time. Hopefully we can sustain these things, because a lot of these services have potential for making revenues. There are a lot of sponsors willing to sponsor. There are lots of services that people pay out of their pocket for fitness, for diet, for, you know, all those things. So our vision is to create those kind of support and all the necessary blueprints for this kind of institution, so that we can create chapters of this institution elsewhere, and that would be like to replicate this model.
Yes.
So we didn't have time, and just show the one slide very quickly. But the fact is, we used the Fresh Start curriculum in phase one. It was for 4 weeks, but we expanded that to 12 weeks. The problem was at that phase, the groups were open; people could join and leave at each session. So we had created a kind of an agenda
that if your first session, you cover some of the first session well, you cover some of the second session. But for the phase two, we decided that it would be more efficient to create a cohort of the group of people and then close the group. So these like 10, 15 people, they all come at the same time and they follow and they graduate. For that curriculum, we used the Fresh Start curriculum for 4 weeks, but we added the 2-week motivation enhancement at the beginning of the curriculum. Excuse me. And then 3 weeks bi-weekly sessions for relapse prevention. Now for phase three, we actually kept the first part, which is the motivation enhancement and the quit smoking. But then we borrowed different things from other curriculums. We merged like 5-6 curriculums together. So we came up with an agenda for the session, and then we had this toolbox. So the toolboxes was, for example, if you are concerned about weight gain, so there will be a tool for how to address that. If your concern is about relationships and aggression and things like that, so there will be a tool for that. So it's not one size fits all. So you have an agenda for everyone, but based on people's need, you choose different tools. And then the relapse prevention, we specialized that. So there was in tracks. So one track is about diet and healthy eating. Another track is about physical activities, yoga, meditation, Zumba, and then
life skills.
Another one would be about the relationship management and then financial planning, things like that. So people can choose go to this track or they can mix and match, one session described, one session another. For phase four, I briefly described, now we have a whole system that there will be a clock. So people who smoke haven't made that decision about when is their quit day. They're entitled to be among other smokers who are contemplating. So it's a quit preparation clock. If they are ready to take action, depending on if they have time, we say come to for 4 week sessions. If they don't have time, we say come to just one session. If they don't have time for that one session, we give them the self-help material and nicotine replacement treatment, and they go and follow the instructions. And then if they quit and they think they may relapse, there will be another club. That club is to stay quiet. So they come and they encourage each other to stay.
Just a quick question,
feedback
on that. From
we work with specific outreaches that already had classes going on, where their action counselors were invited to our class. The people that we worked with, like we went into a behavioral health facility and we worked with their population, so we had information for each person, we had direct connections with their counselors, we had direct, so we could actually talk to who their mental health therapists or their behavioral health specialists were on site, like they were there for us to go. So it wasn't like we were testing the water. We were like, if someone literally was like bipolar or schizophrenic, their counselor was there, and they're like, yeah, she gets a little, and if they literally were there, so that helped us to be able to communicate to each person on an individual level. So
I think that speaks volumes into using the community approach, because you don't want to pull them out of their existing service and you don't want to add on to another service. So using that community approach where we're providing service at a center where they're already participating in kind of normalizes it, kind of gets them involved. They don't have to come to another point. They're already there, so meet them where they are.
And one of the many remarkable things about this project, I don't have to tell you guys what the success rate for quit attempts. First of all, 70% of everybody who smokes wants to not smoke. It's a hateful, awful habit. But it is, as Surgeon General Koop first told us, the most addictive drug we know. Unassisted quit rates, and 28% of all smokers try to quit every year, are between 2 and 4%. Look at the results that they're getting. They have made it a social event. And I think starting to smoke is a social event as well, so this makes a whole lot of sense to me. Those of you who work with the mentally ill know what a huge majority of them smoke, because clearly the nicotine is quieting the voices, not very efficiently, not for very long, but that's a particularly recalcitrant population, and they've never feared to go marching in there too. One of the things that,
I just want to add that the remarkable part about working with CBPR is we are in the community. So where doctors are not reachable, when I go to the market, I see participants, Tamika, wait a minute, can I ask you a question? So every event, we're actually in the community with the people that we serve on a daily basis. So we really connect with them on another level. So people are inviting us to birthday parties, and we are there to help with every aspect of life. So when they have, I've been quit for a year, I'm having a party, where are the peer motivators? I want them to come, they change my life. So when you get that going on, when you've been dealing with your doctor and you have a cold and the cold is gone, the doctor doesn't celebrate you, but the thief celebrates you. I just want you to understand how important it is to keep this CBPR going, because the community educates the community. What better way to get it done than to do it ourselves?
And one of the things that, you know, was kind of, advance of this was the teaching of intergenerational teaching. So as people pointed out, kids teaching their parents, kids teaching their grandparents, because some of these households that we work with, they have a parent, a grandparent, some cousins all in the house, and they get to learn this curriculum from somebody else. So they get the excitement, they get the body, and they get to learn about it. So even if we never see that person, they're still getting some information from the participants that we have.
Lynn Cook, and let me just briefly introduce her to you. Sorry about that. Lynn is a wonderful old tobacco warrior. She and I go way, way back. She's one of my best friends in the world. And now she's running the undergraduate public health program at University of Maryland, Shady Grove. Okay.
It's about, both of the city public schools are tobacco free, but the playing fields around them aren't. And I literally stood up and I'm like, I have asthmatic children. My son is a football player. I watched him trot after winning a football game through a cloud of smoke and have an asthma attack right there on the side of the field. And I had my son with me. He stood up, was standing there. So that was just a little glimpse of what can happen, because everyone's like, oh my gosh, are you? And you could feel the power, you could feel it in the room. So. No, that's not some place that I thought I'd ever be, and City Hall's often to be, but Steve drives and gives you the motivation so much, and understanding how I didn't feel empowered before, but now, oh my gosh, then talking to the peer motivators and knowing what we do as an everyday thing, the peer Yvonne literally was like, when's another hearing? I want to go. I want to, you know, so knowing that it gives us the tools that we need to be productive members in our communities, to do the things that normally we wouldn't even have thought of. Thank you, Steve. Oh, there are the peer motivators in the room. I'm sorry. Yes, other peer motivators, please stand. Because they are superheroes.
Southwest Baltimore is one of the poorest neighborhoods in America, as a matter of fact. This is not a neighborhood of privilege. This is, and I would just like to ask, what difference have you made permanently in that neighborhood? What do they feel about themselves now?
Oh my gosh, a whole bunch of people feel a whole bunch of stuff, and it's different now. No, really, especially after, and I hate referring back to this, but after the riots in Baltimore City, knowing what the youth in Baltimore City are capable of. But no, when that happened, we weren't in one of the youth advisory coalition meetings. And I literally took everybody's phones. No, you're not going to know what's going on right now. And the youth in that meeting felt, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding me. I know why the kids are doing that. They don't have a voice. We would never do that because we're given a voice. Our voices are being heard. So we need to do this, and we need to. So the kids went back to their schools, and they had these forums. And I'm sitting here like, whoa, wait a minute. Principals are calling. So now the kids came to our youth conference, and it's like, oh, this is the group that got the kids to serve. You don't understand what that little bit of empowerment does for the whole community. Now the people in our community are literally coming knocking on the Chief's door. What else the Chief has going on? What is going on? So we used to literally just have classes in little remote spaces all over. Now people are called, hey, can Chief have a class at our business? Because Chief comes in, we're going to smoke free next month. Can you do a class here? So knowing that it gives everybody that vehicle that it needs to keep on moving. Marisa, community hug. We had our very first community hug the Friday after the the curfew was lifted in Baltimore City. And the community hug was just a way to say, we're here, we need to come back outside, it's safe, we can do this. So Steve put out money, we had a barbecue, everyone in the community came, we danced, we sang, the businesses donated things, and it was just a big open community hug. We had some people come, and since then we had a community hug every month until the end of the summer, because it's a way to just get out in the community and say, hey, we're all here, let's see what we can do for one another. We've had people come to the community hug that were new to the area, but because we do flyers and everything, they were college kids that just started at the University of Maryland, standing around, they're like, when do we start hugging? So that particular night, this was our meeting in August, and we're like, we're new to the community, we don't know anybody, but we saw this thing just this community. So we literally walked around hugging everybody. But that little bit of something does so much. And so every month, everyone's look, last Friday of the month, it's community hug, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. So we can't wait until next year to see what's coming out of the community hug. Come to Baltimore, community hug.
As a matter of fact, Mika, I don't know where she got it, showed up with a pony at one of the community hugs.
He had it in one.
And people were asking if it was real.
It was. You just got to understand that living where we live, you can expect anything to happen. And so when people do look for just anything, because it has the Thief brand now, like Thief does anything to make the community better. So just seeing the kids, the parents were doing surveys at that community hug. It's like their parents were busy. So I have a friend that has a pony and he dropped it off and everyone's like, you're walking up. I'm like, no, he's here for a ride. Bring the kids so their parents can go do surveys. Send the kids over here. So we did pony rides around the. It was hilarious. People were like, you're not walking a dog. You're walking a pony. Which, like I said, in our community, that type of stuff is unheard of. This is something that kids like in our community don't get to do. But giving them that option puts it on Teeth. And it's like, Teeth is anything for our community. So it all looks good for Teeth. So I love it.
All right, the website is ceasebaltimore.org, and as I said at the beginning, I really think this is going to be a model for the world.
Yes.
I couldn't be more proud of them. Thank you.